All right, so let's read sections 5 and 6, chapter 21 of the Confession, page 860 in your hymnal. The reading of the Scriptures with godly fear, the sound preaching and conscionable hearing of the Word, in obedience unto God, with understanding, faith, and reverence, singing of psalms with grace in the heart. You're waiting for a verb? Trust me, there is. A verb will come. Just think German. As also the due administration of, and worthy receiving of the sacraments instituted by Christ, there comes the verb, are all parts of the ordinary religious worship of God. Besides religious oaths, vows, solemn fastings, and thanksgivings upon special occasions, which are in their several times and seasons to be used in a holy and religious manner. So in other words, they're telling you there's two lists of things. They're the list of things that are part of ordinary worship. In other words, they ought to be in every worship service. And then the things that are only occasionally to be part of a worship service. And then paragraph 6. Neither prayer nor any other part of religious worship is now, under the gospel, either tied unto or made more acceptable by any place in which it is performed or towards which it is directed. But God is to be worshipped everywhere in spirit and truth, as in private families daily and in secret, every one by himself, so more solemnly in the public assemblies, which are not carelessly or willfully to be neglected or forsaken, when God by his word or providence calleth thereunto. All right. The first two paragraphs, just to recap, the first two paragraphs are about who we should worship and the rule by which we should worship, the rule by which we should govern our worship, namely the regulative principle. The next two paragraphs were about prayer. Now we come to two paragraphs which cover everything else in a worship service. And then the final two paragraphs, as I said, are on the Sabbath day, which we will not treat in this installment, this dose of the Westminster Confession. So here we have in 5 and 6 the elements and then the place of worship. There's a lot in here. I got one day, and so I'm gonna basically hit the high points, the things that interested me, hoping that if they interest me, there's a chance they might interest you. So, first of all, they gave us that list of elements in what they call the ordinary worship of God. Reading of Scripture, preaching and hearing of the Word, singing of psalms, administration of the sacraments. Well, the first thing that jumps out at me, I'm going to ask you a question. You notice anything missing from that list? Is there anything in that list of elements of worship that you, or is there anything you think ought to be in that list that you don't see? Liturgical dance. Okay. Fortunately for you, all the rest of the elders are in another meeting interviewing a candidate for office. So you only have one witness against you, not to mention in the court. Yeah, dance obviously is not mentioned there. What's that? Hymns. Now explain why you say hymns are not there. Okay, I'm going to come back to that. But that's something we need to discuss for sure. Anything else missing? If you were a minister, you'd notice this immediately.
Offering.
Yeah, if you were a minister's wife, you'd really notice it immediately. There's no offering. You notice there's no offering for the support of the church. There are places, I think somewhere, not actually even in this one. Seems like, I can't even remember. There was something about an offering to relieve distress, you know, what we would call our deacon's offering. But there's nothing in here about an offering to support the ministry of the church, to pay the pastor, to buy coal for the scuttle in the church, or indeed to support missionaries, to produce Sunday school material, which of course didn't exist in those days. There's nothing in there about that. And that's kind of interesting. I think it's fascinating. They're trying to tell you. Remember, these are people who very much believe that we only do in worship what God commands us to do. And in fact, we do in worship what God commands us to do. But they didn't think, apparently, it never occurred to them, that God was commanding them to support their ministers. Why? Were ministers all rich in those days? Far from it. I think the main reason it didn't occur to them, and this is an example of being controlled by your society, having your thought view, your blinkers
created by the time in which you live and the way everything is done, and the way everything was done in those days, at least in the state churches, was that the government supported the churches effectively. Or more accurately, in England, the church owned most of England, owned a huge chunk of England, and every church, every parish, had a collection of farms and forests attached to it, at least in the bookkeeping sense. They may be nowhere near, physically, geographically, the church, but the idea was that this forest and that farm are part of the living. They create the living of such and such a vicarage. And the idea was that it was the agricultural produce of, or timber produce of the land that supported the minister. And in a day when prices were relatively stable, and they were in that time, you could say that such and such a vicarage has a living of 400 pounds attached to it. Because that's pretty much what it generated every year. And that's, if you were the minister, that's what you got. And that's where it came from. The people were not used to giving an offering to support anything. Except for taxes. And of course, even those were not the sort of routine institutionalized thing that we have. In those days, taxes had to be voted by Parliament. And the king only called the Parliament when he needed taxes. So basically, when he summoned Parliament into being, he's basically saying, new taxes. And then, you know, Parliament traditionally voted the tax, but in the 1600s, they started saying, no, I don't think we're going to vote the tax. And so the king would vote, would just prorogue them, you know, say, done, we're done with Parliament. And there were long stretches. There was at least an 11-year stretch during this time where the king never called Parliament into being, because the only purpose for them was to vote taxes, and they made it clear they weren't going to vote taxes. And so the king had to raise money other ways. Well, anyhow, slipping into a discussion of the English Civil War, because it's interesting, and I'm reading a fascinating book on it, but that's not what you came for. The fact is, people in those days were not in the habit of supporting the church with their own money. The church was way richer than they were. And by the way, just to add to sort of round off the story, different parishes had different livings attached to them. And so it was quite the thing in those days, and well into the 1800s, for English churchmen to be sort of trading up. I want to be the minister of that parish. And they didn't do that sort of pseudo-spiritual thing that our ministers do now. The Lord is calling me to another church. I've tried this church for 5 years, and I'm tired of it, and I've actually preached all the sermons I know. I want to go preach them at another place. We're fortunate here in our church, and really in our presbytery, to have a bunch of men who believe that ministry is something you should do for your whole life, and preferably at one place. But that's not the American routine. American ministers change jobs every 4 years. In our PCA, because we're so solid and traditional-minded, our guys only change jobs every 5 years. And that's obviously, I think obviously, not very healthy. But in those days, they didn't even make any bones. We're trading up. I want to go be minister of that vicarage because, you know, the one I've got's 400 pounds, and I want to trade up to a 600-pound or 1,000-pound place. And that's just the way it worked. So, again, the people would not have thought this way, and the divines themselves didn't think about offerings as a way to, as the way, in fact, to support the church. And therefore, it just didn't occur to them as something that should have been in the elements of worship, something that God commanded them to do. They should have had some clue about that in the Old Testament. Certainly, it was made relatively clear. I had a little argument with my wife about this, but it was clear to a certain extent that some of the offering, some of the meat, grain, and oil that the offerer brought, although some of it was consumed by the offerer himself, some of it was consumed by the fire, a significant portion was given to the priest. It was part of his paycheck. Now, you all also recall that the Levites were scattered throughout the territories of the other tribes. They didn't have their own, you know, physical allotment like the other tribes did. And they farmed throughout the year. So they, in a sense, they were all tent makers for part of their income. But still, part of their income did come from their people. And Paul tells us, for instance, in 1 Corinthians 9:9, that ministers, in fact, are to be supported by their people. There's actually a little bit of pushback there. He has to say this. It wasn't apparently obvious. But he has to say, yeah, no, it is our right to be supported. It's the way it should be. And he mentions the Old Testament command that the ox not be muzzled while it is threshing. You know, the idea is the ox is working the threshing machine, and you know, there's grain spilling on the ground. Well, the ox is working for you, and there's grain there. It's essentially his right. The ox's right to eat some of this grain. After all, he's working for you and working for it. And Paul equates the minister to an ox, and says the minister is working for you. He should be paid by you. So anyhow, that's interesting that it's not there. By the way, just rambling on this subject, I got interested wondering about the Church of Scotland today. You know, we've heard a lot about the Church of Scotland. We have connections there, and of course our young people stay, those who attend Covenant High School and go on the every 2-year trip, biannual, I think, is that the right word? They stay with congregations in the Church of Scotland, and the Church of Scotland congregation in New Milns, Loudoun Parish, that we're connected to, is struggling with what to do now in the Church of Scotland, as the church has accepted homosexuals into the ministry. They're deciding what to do. And as you've heard Pastor Raymond point out, the Church of Scotland is the state church. It is essentially the Church of England equivalent in Scotland. The church owns most of the buildings in the Church of Scotland. Very few congregations own their own property. I got curious, so what about the ministers? Are they still under this deal? Now, it'd be pleasant to relate that, you know, they don't have farms, because farming produces nothing, that, you know, each church has its own oil well out there in the North Sea. It doesn't, unfortunately, work quite like that, but there is a fascinating deal. You know how on your taxes you can check off a thing that says $1 of my taxes will go to the presidential reelection campaign? Well, they have that for your church. And I'm not entirely sure whether you do this. I think you personally, with your income taxes, somehow you say, I sent this much, I wrote this many checks to my own congregation of the Church of Scotland. And what they do is they take up to 25% of the tax that you pay and send a check right back to your congregation. It doesn't increase your tax. And at least on the face of it, it's not like they're taking someone else's tax money and diverting it to the church. That would be wicked. But of course they are, because 25% of your taxes immediately go back to your church, which means that, you know, the amount of money you pay in tax to the government gets, for the government's own purposes, is reduced, and someone has to make up that difference. So even today, in this horribly secular age, terribly secular age, the Church of Scotland can get a significant chunk of money back. Now, it's what people pay out of their taxes, but they have to pay that money anyway. So it's not like the people are really used to paying for the church. And, that, of course, that's another thing. When they leave the denomination, if they do, not only do they probably lose their building, they now have to pay the whole salary of their minister. They've been used to paying some of it and getting, you know, that 25% for free, as it were. So that's a powerful disincentive to leave the big state church, and that's what a lot of these people are wrestling with. All right, lots of discussion there. Now, so there's the elements, the things that they think ought to be part of every worship service. We noted one that jumps right out at us, but which they had not put in, namely support offerings to support the church. Having talked about the elements, I'd like you to go back and look at that list and note the modifiers. It's an interesting list. They don't just say you need to do this, 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 and this. Everything they say comes with some sort of modification. So, reading the scriptures, but they say reading the scriptures with godly fear. Sound preaching, it's got to be sound. So here's a responsibility for the minister and for the officers of the church who guard the pulpit. And conscionable hearing of the word. It's interesting. The hearing of the word is actually considered an element in their thinking, and it needs to be conscious. You need to be thinking about what you're hearing. So it's not just enough to have the hearing. It has to be heard in a certain way. And it has to be heard in obedience unto God, with understanding, faith, and reverence. Then the singing of psalms, but you don't just sing. You sing with grace in the heart. Never says you have to sing in tune. You ought to do that, but it's not actually of the essence of worship. So sing right out. And then the due administration, whatever that means, and the worthy receiving of the sacraments. So I'm not going to say a whole lot about this. This is sort of the thing that it's more requires preaching rather than teaching. It requires meditation. It requires some self-examination. And it requires, I would say, a vow, an intention on your part every time you come into worship to think to yourself, okay, I'm going to be hearing the scriptures. How should I be hearing them? I should be hearing them with godly fear. I'm going to be hearing a sermon. I should be hearing the sermon with understanding, faith, and reverence. I'm singing a psalm. I'm not just going, I should be singing them with grace in the heart. In other words, there's an encouragement and exhortation here for our worship, how we ought to be worshiping God. And I hope you even remember what I said earlier about the importance of form and heart in worship. Form meaning what we do and the sort of the outer ways in which we do it. That's important. You know, you touch the Ark of the Covenant as it's tottering on its cart and you get smoked because you weren't supposed to touch it. Form matters. There are rules about form. But there are rules about heart, and heart makes is more important. They're both important, but the heart trumps the form. You ought to be doing both. And worship that's scrupulously correct on the surface, but there's no heart involvement is useless. God does not appreciate it, and in fact, God hates it in you, and he says, I cover my ears when you pray and don't mean it, when you pray from an ungodly heart. And so anyhow, those thoughts ought to come back to your mind here. What's important is what we do, but it's what's even more important is how we do what we do. All right, so the modifiers. I'm going to go out of my order here a little bit. Nancy brought up singing of psalms. And, of course, Nancy, when you read that, you think to yourself, and now you think to all of us because you're going to say it out loud, you think, yeah, she's thinking exclusive psalmody. Are they saying that the only singing we are to do are of the 150 canonical psalms in the book of the Psalter? And as I mentioned another week, there are Christians, it used to be the dominant view in Presbyterianism. It is still very common in Scotland, and there is at least one Reformed denomination in the United States, the RPCNA, Reformed Presbyterian Church North America, whose tradition is that they sing only English translations, metrified, of the psalm. Oh, my wife is back. And we talked a little bit about that another day, and why I thought that was not a defensible position. Let me just say a couple more words on that. Not that I imagine any of you are terribly exercised about this, but if you are, and even if you aren't, it's probably good to know. First of all, there's been a lot of study done on the practices of the various Presbyterian and Reformed churches in the 1500s and 1600s, the time that culminated in the writing of the Westminster Confession. And the scholarly consensus seems to be that the word psalm was used in a generic way to mean a religious psalm. It was not used to mean only those 150 poems in the book of the Psalter. And so when an Englishman of that period wrote Singing of Psalms, he was not necessarily restricting himself, did not think that he was restricting himself to the book of Psalter. He was using psalm in a general way. As I pointed out, I think a week or two ago, the word psalm comes from a Greek word, solos, which means to pluck. The idea, in fact, is the plucking of an instrument, which actually brings up a whole other problem. But it certainly didn't mean just those 150 songs. There are other songs, of course, in the Bible. And there are some, I believe there are some exclusive psalmists who would say, well, okay, you can sing the song of Moses, you can sing the song of Miriam, you can sing some of these other things. But there are others who think not, who think that the Psalter was given as a hymnal, sort of a hymnal that fell out of heaven, and God said, use this book and no other book. But as I said, in the time of the Westminster Confession, the word psalm was a more general term, and therefore we're not required to read this, when they say Psalms, as meaning those 150. Another, yes?
I just had a reference here, and I looked it up. And Colossians 3:16, I think it's pretty clear on this. It says, "Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, teaching and admonishing one another in all wisdom, singing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs with thankfulness in your hearts to God."
Exactly. Yeah, in fact, I mentioned that, I think, a week when you weren't here. Yeah, if those words all mean the same thing, which is what exclusive psalmists are forced to say, then the exclusive psalmists have Paul saying, you know, I want you to sing psalms and psalms and psalms, as if Paul was a real estate agent. Location, location, location. Okay, I think that's kind of silly, but yeah, exactly. There's a place in the scriptures that certainly makes it sound like, in that case, particularly if Psalms really means the biblical 150 Psalms, that Paul is saying, yeah, those and other things. We have a number of places in the Bible where we're told to sing a new song. In fact, singing a new song is the way God's people respond to God's mighty hand in salvation. The people of Israel are led through the Red Sea and they sing a new psalm. In fact, we have that in the Bible. There's a psalm written, and Miriam, you know, teaches the women's parts or whatever. But the fact is, their response is to sing. And it's very bizarre. Well, I'll just go on. Isaiah, just give you a reference or two. Isaiah 42, verse 11 or so, I think it was. The people, maybe it was 10, talk about singing a new song in response to the salvation of the Lord. You come to Revelation 5:9, 14:3. Again, the people sing a new song. The idea is God does something great for you, and you sit here and think, all right, I'll just, you know, sit in my hands. Well, of course not. They sing a new psalm, a song rather. They respond. It is entirely bizarre to think that the people of Israel, so excited about being delivered from Egypt, which really is the prototype, it is the number one shadow, as it were, of the death of Christ on the cross. It is the climactic Old Testament moment of redemption. There's one great moment of redemption in the Old Testament and one great moment of redemption in the New Testament. Great moment of redemption in the Old Testament. They're redeemed by the strong hand of God from the bondage to Israel, and their response is to sing. It's just, it beggars the imagination. I love that phrase. To think that the people of God could experience the greater work of redemption on the cross and not respond the same way the faithless horde of Israel, and that's what we're talking about in the Passover, in the Exodus generation, for them not to respond in the same way and sing. It's amazing to think that we, our book of song, where we pour out our praise in a sense the most exalted way by singing, we're forbidden from mentioning the name of Jesus. That might be the single clincher for me. If the exclusive psalmists are saying, you must not sing the name of Jesus. Can you imagine a more bizarre rule of worship? That's insane. That's not to say that the psalms don't speak of Jesus. They all speak of Jesus. But they don't mention his name. Why not sing songs that are talk about his name? And the psalms, they touch on a lot of important things, but they don't touch on justification by faith to the degree that we can now talk about it. We know more about it. By the way, just pop quiz time here. It's my last crack at you all. Pop quiz. If you were looking for an Old Testament psalm about justification by faith, which one would you come up with? And I'll just preface this by saying, you don't have to get Mr. Pfefferly's answer as good as I'm sure my answer would be. You just have to get Paul's answer. Which is another way of saying, what psalm does Paul refer to when he wants... I feel like I keep moving this back. Pig Barton? 119. Is there a particular passage in there you're thinking of? Okay, well, that's a good choice because, frankly, Psalm 119 is so long, so big. It's probably got it in there. At least it's a good shot. It's actually not the one that Paul and Mike Pfefferly had in mind. It's, yes.
Was that Psalm 40?
It's actually Psalm 32. Psalm 30, when Paul is trying, in Romans chapter 3 and 4, he wants to demonstrate that this doctrine of justification is not a newfangled thing, but that it comes from the Old Testament. He has two examples. One, of course, is Abraham. But just in case you think that somehow the Mosaic Law did away with that, in fact, there's a whole school of theology in one of the larger states of the Union that teaches that exact point. But in case you think that somehow the Mosaic Law did away with justification by faith, he also quotes David, who lived under the Mosaic period. And he quotes David in Psalm 32, where David says, "How blessed is a man sins God does not count against him." And Paul says he's teaching justification by faith. You're made right by God and not by your own works. God hides your sins. That's justification by faith, says the Apostle Paul. Anyhow, Psalm 32, justification by faith in the Psalter. And then I guess one more example, since we're hearing the book of Luke in morning worship these days. When the angel comes to Mary, yeah, what's her name? Mary, and tells her the great things are going to happen, what does she do? She breaks out in song, exactly. She sings. She sings a new song about God bringing this wonderful promised deliverance that's sung about in the Psalms and lots of other places. And now it's being brought forth in history, and she can't help but bring forth a song of her own. And so for all those reasons, I think that the idea that we're only allowed to sing a metrical form, and I always have to point this out because we're actually not singing the Bible, we're singing a metrical version of a few of the 150 Psalms, To limit ourselves to that is, I think, kind of silly. Now, that's not to say that we shouldn't be singing the Psalms. I think that most American Christians ought to be singing more of the Psalms than they are, both more of the 150 Psalms. And Psalms ought to form some version of a Psalm ought to form a bigger proportion of their sung worship. The Psalms are great models, but they're not necessarily the ones that we should be restricting ourselves, just as we ought to be praying biblical prayers, I think, a little more often. We certainly ought to be looking at biblical prayers and looking at the way they're shaped and formed and learning from those prayers, modeling our prayers on the way biblical prayers, Old and New Testament, are, because that would just help us. We learn by watching the Master do it, and that's true in every field. Well, we ought to learn by praying by listening to, studying, and imitating the best of prayers that God has preserved for us. All right, I move on. I've talked about the offering. I've talked about the way we're to do the things we're supposed to do in Scripture. So I talked about this. I talked about that. Oh, due administration of the sacraments. Did you notice that we got the list here? Reading scriptures, preaching, hearing of the word, singing, semicolon. As also the due administration and worthy receiving of the sacraments instituted by Christ. They make a distinction between the things that ought to be in the ordinary worship and the things that, and they don't say it in so many words, that ought to be in the ordinary but not quite that ordinary worship of God. They make a distinction there. And when they say sacraments, we jump ahead. Chapter 27 makes it clear, in case you were wondering, that when they say sacraments, they mean two, baptism and the Lord's Supper. And naturally, you can't have a baptism every week. It can't be a regular part of worship the way the preaching of the word is, not even if the Pates are members of your congregation. You only have baptisms when there's an occasion for it, when there's a new baby in the congregation or an adult has come to faith from outside of the covenant. So naturally, that can't be a scheduled weekly event. But why not? Why not the Lord's Supper? And the fact is, they just sort of assumed that. I'm not aware, frankly, that anybody in the Westminster Divines period really argued too much about this. You know, perhaps, that at the time of the Reformation, the Mass was part of every real worship service. But on the other hand, the vast majority of Roman Catholics, the vast majority of members of the church, that is, in those days, took of communion once a year, and that only under compulsion. They actually had to issue canons of the church, laws of the church, that said you must take the communion at least once a year.
Are you talking about the Roman Catholics?
Yes.
Roman Catholics?
No, I say they specially had it. They had it when there was no one else except the Greeks. No, the priest had it 4 or 5 times a day. The people had it once a year.
Really?
Yeah.
It's only the bread.
Well, of course, the people never. Yeah, the people didn't have the whole thing either.
They would go to Mass and just watch the priest have communion.
Yeah. They would just go and watch other people do things. Who could imagine a society in which people would all file into a big room, sit in their seats, and watch other people do something? He says during the NCAA basketball playoffs. Is that so?
Yeah, because people thought when the priest said, hocus pocus, man, the body. They
right.
Latin.
Yeah.
He thought
he
was saying hocus pocus.
Yeah. Well, okay, so.
It's a magic trick.
Exactly. So, at the time of the Reformation, what people did was they watched. And the Lord's Supper was taken very infrequently. And, of course, the people weren't allowed to drink the wine anyway. They only got the bread. And so, at the time of the Reformation, a number of reformers said, hey, wait a minute. First of all, the sort of the superstitious theory that grew up around the Mass that, you know, you're actually aren't eating real pieces of Jesus. And that's why, for instance, you couldn't eat food in the morning because it was deeply sinful to have Jesus, you know, come down the elementary tract and land on top of food. But you, of course, went out and ate afterwards. It was okay to have food come down on top of Jesus. I don't understand the whole deal. But there was a whole thing based up. Well, the reformers said, that's silly. That's superstitious. We ought to respond in love, in worship, in adoration, and in trust, in faith, with the Lord's Supper frequently. And, of course, Calvin wanted it every week. And Calvin was such an ecclesiastical tyrant that he was only given once every, 4 times a year. He actually tried to space it out in the congregations in Geneva. So, you know, Faith Presbyterian would be a Monday, first Sunday of the week. And, you know, BP downtown would be a second Sunday, you know, whatever. So the idea is you could get it every week if you church hopped. Wow, Calvin was in favor of church hopping. He got shot down on that too. The city fathers said, no, must be the same Sunday. There was this superstition, and of course in America, in at least the churches I grew up in as a Christian, it was understood it was always once a month, always the first Sunday. But there are other churches in which it's much less common. When I was in seminary for a while, I attended a Christian Reformed church where they did four times a year, once a quarter. And there was a big deal before the Lord's Supper. A pair of elders would visit every single person in the congregation, which obviously is another reason they didn't do it every week. But it was a big deal. And they had close communion, which means only members of the church or people who had been personally examined by the elders could partake of communion there and so on. Well, this is another example, by the way, of men pretty much just sort of going with what they're used to. And because I want to pick on this fellow who's way smarter than I am, but which means he's usually right, but when I'm right, I like to pick on him. And he's a man I respect, so you got to take that with, as it was. I'm not trying to rip the guy down, but here's even one of the most intelligent guys I know about and for whom I have a great deal of respect. This is Gordon Clark, who taught philosophy at a number of places, finished his career at Covenant College. In his commentary on the Confession, he says, the congregation at all regular meetings should engage in prayer, praise, reading, and preaching of the word, as well as, at stated intervals, administering the sacraments. He just throws that out. He doesn't give any justification. He doesn't explain why the preaching of the word ought to be only at stated intervals. One of the things I've been told by members of churches I've been in is, well, if we had the Lord's Supper every week, it would become routine. Well, we preach every week, and let me tell you, I've heard some pretty routine sermons from time to time in various churches. And I know that a lot of my fellow church members, and occasionally me from time to time, have heard in a routine way have not been hearing in with godly fear, conscionable hearing, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's kind of a silly argument. Why would one thing not be routine when another thing is routine? Again, I think those people just tried to justify tradition. And as I said at some other point in this class, tradition is important. The whole of Christianity can be described as a tradition, something handed down. But we're also warned against the tradition of the elders. The Bereans are commended because when they heard the Apostle Paul, of all people, they nevertheless searched the Scriptures to see if these things were true. And one of the glories of the Reformed tradition at its best, and we haven't always been at our best, but one of the glories of the Reformed tradition has been a willingness to go back to the sources, you know, ad fontes in Latin, go back to the sources, look at the Scriptures and say, well, wait a minute, what really is the true teaching on this subject? And it's interesting, at least in our circles, there's a wave of that. I see the hands, got the hands, they're up here. Is that we have at times gone back to the sources and said, let's see what the Bible really says about this, and more frequent communion is becoming much more frequent, much more widespread in our circles, in our own presbytery. I think the vast majority of churches have weekly communion. All right, now I think Robert had his hand up a long time ago.
Oh, you actually answered the question.
Excellent, I love it when that happens. Then there were hands here. David.
Just would wonder if perhaps Dr. Clark was sidestepping the discussion. Perhaps he had a conclusion of his own that it should be more frequent than the denomination was doing at that time, but he wasn't going to really go into that.
Was Dr. Clark at the college when you were there?
Yes.
Did you ever have a class with him?
Okay.
Do you think Dr. Clark was the kind of guy who would ever shy away from expressing a controversial opinion?
But he also was not someone who could not speak his mind unambiguously, and that's sort of what's implied in what he said.
Okay. All right. And then now...
Yeah, I wanted to share. I grew up in PC. Well, it was PCUSA, and then we left for EPC. My sisters went on to Wheaton College. My older sister in particular, when she started church shopping in this brand new world of all these different possibilities, and pretty quickly she settled on Episcopal churches. And for one big reason was for her that, wow, we can have the Eucharist every Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't you do that? And what's the justification? And so since then, it's been a non-starter for her and her family. When they're moving to a new area to look for a church, they wouldn't dream of going to a church that didn't have Eucharist or communion every Sunday.
Yeah.
And I think the Reformed circles maybe lose more people that way than they imagine.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions? All right. Let's see. So I've talked about all those things. What else did I want to talk about? Yes. Oh, I have a whole other page of notes. I better get going here. All right. And then they listed the ordinary things, the things that ought to be in worship every week, plus the things that ought to be frequent but not that frequent, Lord's Supper. Then they have a second category where it begins, besides religious oaths, vows, solemn fastings, and thanksgivings upon special occasion. There are some things that they think ought to be in worship from time to time. They are occasional. That is to say, you have them only when there is an occasion for them. That is, when there is a specific reason. So they mention oaths and vows. And so in their thinking, when the whole church body senses the need for some unified, some concerted application of themselves for a common cause, then it's appropriate, they say, to have as part of the worship service a communal oath and vow. They naturally, individuals, they would say, ought to be doing these things for their personal reasons, as it were, based on circumstances in their lives. But when there's something that affects the entire congregation, that's appropriate, they say, for the church to come together and make an oath. One example from the Scriptures that comes to mind, mostly because that's where I was in my reading. You remember in the book of Nehemiah, when Nehemiah discovers to his horror that lots of the returned Jews have married non-Jewish people. Well, they come together and at his prodding take an oath to put away their pagan wives and not marry any more pagan wives. Whether that was in a weekly worship service, I don't know. But that's an example where something that affected the whole congregation, the whole people. They were all, most of them were implicated in this sin. It was sort of a group activity that they said, we all as a body need to take an oath, make a vow, to put away this sin and not to follow it in the future. A historical example that no doubt comes to your mind, especially of a child that is going to Great Britain this year, but fortunately not mine. I don't think mine has learned a thing about British history. But he should have learned, and I'm sure, well, for instance, Dr. Gross, they talk about this at the dinner table. And so he's thinking, he's just straining, he's just saying, oh, I want to answer this. And he wants to say the National Covenant of Scotland in 1638, when the Church of Scotland essentially instigated and made it part of the religious life to sign this National Covenant resisting Roman Catholicism, by which they meant Charles I and William Laud. That was a time when they felt it was necessary for them all to come together to protect their religion. Oaths and vows. Likewise, they mention fastings, solemn fastings upon something that affects the whole church. Common needs like a plague, floods, these things happen. When the British army gets beaten by the Zulus, all those things lead to moments of fasting in the church when they confess their sins and say, oh, bad things have come upon us, and please take these bad things away from us. And then they mention thanksgivings, which, of course, is when you go and beat the Zulus. You declare a day of thanksgiving and so on. And that also means you should all go out and watch Zulu again with Michael Caine. All right. No reaction whatsoever. Yes, the Battle of Rorke's Drift. And even if you're not interested in military history, and you should, here's a little battle where one little company of infantry won 11 Victoria Crosses in one day, the most that were ever awarded in one day's battle. And all the more impressive, by the way, because in those days, you actually had to live to win the Victoria Cross. Nowadays, you almost have to die to win the Purple Heart. The Victoria Cross is the British equivalent, and you can actually, in those days, 1879, you could only be awarded it if you were actually survived. It was not given posthumously. And everyone given the prize was named Jones. Why, you ask? Because this is a Welsh unit that was in battle. And all Welshmen are named Jones or Williams, or occasionally Davies. Anyway, enough of that. But that was, by the way, the film debut of Michael Caine. It's a fascinating movie. All right. And then we come to the next paragraph, paragraph 6. Oh, no, I'm sorry. One more thing about that. You've got to watch the movie if only to listen to the men, Welshmen, sing Men of Harlech. If you want to know a little bit of what heaven will sound like, it's Welshmen singing Men of Harlech. There you go. You can actually get that in a number of movies, but Zulu is the best place for that song. Well, they move on. The divines talk about the place. In paragraph 6, they're now talking about the place of worship. And they say, now, under the gospel, which, by the way, they mean Old New Testament, when did the gospel begin? Genesis what? 3:15, I would say, when God tells the serpent that the son of the woman will have his heel bitten, but he will crush the serpent. That's always called the proto-evangelium, the first giving of the gospel. Again, this is more pop, this is sort of pop quiz and kind of review. This is my last day with you on this topic, so it's now sort of like the course final. And so when, I see eyebrows going up and people are starting to get really nervous now. The gospel was proclaimed to Abraham. Where are we told that? Galatians chapter 3, it's actually verse 8. The scripture, seeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel beforehand to Abraham. So when the divines say, under the gospel, what they really mean is not when the gospel was available, but what they mean is New Testament. They're kind of sloppy there. They use that phrase a lot. But I just want to make sure you realize that they are being sloppy because the gospel begins as soon as it is needed. Aren't we thankful for that? That's the Genesis 3. Well, anyhow, what they're saying is that in the New Testament, things change, and in a sense, they do. In the Old Testament era, sacrificial worship was to be given, to be practiced only where God said it to be was to be practiced. In fact, when they're still wandering a little bit, God says, you know, when we come into the promised land and when I point out a place for you, we're not going to do as we do as we're doing now. Every man does his own thing everywhere. All the worship will be concentrated at the place I point out. David conquers the city of Jerusalem, and of course he buys the threshing floor. No, that's something else. Sorry. But buys the city of Jerusalem, conquers the city of Jerusalem, and the temple is built by his son. And at that point, the sacrificial worship is concentrated at that place. And that was the way it should be. The people were told, this is where you offer the sacrificial worship. You're not allowed to go off any old place. And of course, you remember that when the kingdom is split and the northerners go off and form what we now call the kingdom of Israel, their first king says, hey, if I let my people go to Jerusalem to offer worship into the heart of the enemy country, their loyalties will be divided. So he sets up some more places of worship, Shiloh and Samaria and so on. And of course, the Samaritans, who are sort of half-breeds, they're partly Israelite, partly other nations that have been settled into there by the Assyrians, they're claiming, no, our hill of worship is better than your hill of worship. And that debate was still going on in John 4 when Jesus meets the Samaritan woman at the well, and the very famous conversation where she asks, where should we worship? And Jesus doesn't... Let's put it this way. Jesus answers that question the way he answers so many questions. He doesn't. In fact, he answers the question she should have been asking. And so she says, well, you know, where's the right place? Our place or your place? And he says, the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. He actually says, you'll worship neither here nor there. And what he really means is you'll worship everywhere, but you'll worship in spirit and truth. You're asking the wrong question. And so he declares, in a sense, that the temple, the question of whether you can worship in the temple or anywhere else is a non-issue anymore. He has the Old Testament on his side in the book of Malachi. Malachi 1:11 says that the nations will offer incense all over. This is why I hate it when they tape these classes. Incense will be offered throughout the world. And of course, when he says incense, he means the high worship of God. He means the ultimate worship in the temple. And he says it will be offered all over. So even in Malachi, we're being told, when even at a moment when the second temple was at its height of glory, that day will pass away when everyone has to come to the temple. Soon, someday, worship will be given. The full, complete worship of God will be given everywhere. It won't be confined to one nation, one tribe of Israelites, and in fact will be it won't be confined to the land of Palestine. So Malachi points towards that, and so there you go. Well, so the divines, first of all, had in mind the change from Old Testament to New Testament, the passing away of the temple and its worship. So that's the first thing they're saying, is that in this new age, and it is new in certain ways, worship is not confined to the temple, nor do we need to be pointing ourselves, turning to the east, assuming we're west of Jerusalem, to offer our prayer and so on. But they also, they don't say it in so many words, they also have in mind the current events. They always had current events in mind. And what they had in mind is the insistence of William Laud, Archbishop of Canterbury, and his party in the Church of England, which was that you should only worship in a consecrated building. The Laudian principle was that real worship could only be given. Remember, these people were super strict about forms. True worship could only be given in a building that had been consecrated for that purpose by a bishop. Now, they're not talking about what we do. You know, we build a new building or we build onto our building. You know, we go out there with the shovels and we have the honored folk of the congregation turn the first few shovelfuls. And then we pray, Lord, use this new building to for your glory and for your good. And that's a perfectly fine thing to do. But in Laud's mind, they weren't just saying, let's ask the Lord's blessing on what we do here. Laud is saying you have to have a special man, a man who is descended from Christ because he's in the apostolic succession of bishops, pray a special prayer that implants, or sorry, that impresses a particular character on this building. This building is now spiritually a different kind of thing than what the Baptists meet in because they don't have apostolic bishops. Laud insisted on that. He was incensed when he came across a building of the Church of England that had not been consecrated. There certainly were ministers in the Church of England who resisted this. He was furious with that, and he was constantly trying to impose his will upon them and lost his head as a result. The divines have that in mind, too. The divines are saying, you don't need a bishop's blessing on a structure to make the worship of that within that structure what it should be. All right. I have a little bit more in my notes, but I always do. And we're running out of time. And I promised my wife that I would give her 49 seconds for discussion. Okay, so I go back to my notes. I wasn't going to do this, but my wife has brought up. So here we go. This is the part of the notes I wasn't going to give you. I told you what the divines had in mind. The divines had in mind the change from temple to everywhere, Old Testament, New Testament. They had in mind William Laud's insistence on consecration. I think a lot of people today would read this and say, see, I don't have to go to church. Worship isn't dependent on place. I can worship God hiking in the mountains. Or sailing in a boat. And, of course, I'm not really much of a hiker, but I know I could worship really well in a boat. Yeah. Well, I mean, you hear that kind of silliness. I don't need to come to church. I can worship God at the Seahawks game. Now, actually, it takes a lot of faith from what I hear. Not much of a pro football fan, but I think that does take more faith than I have. I only support winning teams like the Boston Bruins. Stanley Cup champions last time out. Very good. Yeah. The divines would never have thought that, and they would be aghast if someone interpreted what they wrote to mean the place doesn't matter, you can worship by yourself in the mountains. No, they absolutely insist, and of course the next two paragraphs of this chapter on the Sabbath day will make it very clear, no, you absolutely had better be in church. They're just saying that church doesn't have to be consecrated. That church doesn't have to be in Jerusalem, but you darn well better be in church on Sunday morning, every Sunday, twice, actually. And they have the Bible on their side. I really will shut myself down with this comment. Think of the writer to the Hebrews who says in 10:25, don't neglect the assembling together of yourselves, as is the habit of some. There were people, even in the good New Testament days, where people thought, I can worship God on mountains and hiking. And the writer of the Hebrews said, oh, no, you can't. You've got to be in church on Sunday. All right, I finished there. You'll notice, of course, there are two paragraphs left. Dr. Gross will pick those up whenever the next dose of this class comes. As I said, the next few weeks will be Dr. Darby. And it is on mental health, is that right? Yes, mental health with Dr. Arby, followed by Dr. Murphy on some other subject that I don't know of.